Welcome to Rethinking Wellness, a podcast that offers critical thinking and compassionate skepticism about wellness and diet culture and reflections on how to find true well-being. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of three books, including Anti-Diet, which was published in 2019, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which came out on February 20th, and The Wellness Trap, which was published in 2023 and is the inspiration for this podcast. You can learn more and get them all at christyharrison.com/books. Hey there, welcome back to Rethinking Wellness. I'm Christy, and my guest today is writer and beauty industry critic Jessica DeFino, who writes the popular Substack newsletter, The Unpublishable. We discuss the intersections of wellness and diet culture and beauty culture, how she went from child beauty pageant participant to working at the Kardashian-Jenner apps, to eventually becoming an outspoken critic of the beauty industry, the problems with skincare, how to question and push back against beauty standards while also having compassion for all the ways we get sucked in, and lots more. This is a great conversation, and I can't wait to share it with you. But first, a few announcements. This podcast is inspired by and brought to you by my second book, The Wellness Trap: Break Free from Diet Culture, Disinformation, and Dubious Diagnoses, and Find Your True Well-Being, which is available wherever books are sold. The book explores the connections between diet and wellness culture and also gets into how the beauty industry intersects with wellness, including some talk of skincare and a deeper dive into the quote-unquote glowing from within idea that I touch on in my interview with Jessica. I also talk a lot about how to think critically about wellness culture and protect yourself from misinformation, and those approaches can certainly apply to the beauty industry as well. So if you like this conversation, I'd love for you to check out the book. That's christyharrison.com/thewellnesstrap or pick it up at your favorite local bookstore. This podcast is also made possible by my paid subscribers at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Not only do paid subscriptions help support the show and keep the lights on over here, but they also get you great perks like bonus episodes with our guests, including one I did with Jessica that'll come out this Friday, subscriber-only Q&As where I answer questions about wellness diets, how to spot scams and misinformation, how to be discerning when it comes to popular wellness trends like gut health, and anything else we cover on this podcast. Paid subscribers also get commenting privileges where you can connect with other listeners. And I have to say, it's been amazing to see the support people are giving each other as our membership grows. Just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com to sign up. That's rethinkingwellness.substack.com. And if you're already a paid subscriber, thank you so much for your support. Now, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Jessica DeFino. So Jessica, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I love your work and all of your writing about beauty culture. And so I'm very interested in talking with you about that and its connections with wellness and diet culture. But I'd love to start off first by talking about you and your own relationship with beauty culture and sort of where that began. I've read that you said you did beauty pageants as a kid. So I'm wondering if that's where it all started for you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I mean, it feels like beauty culture has almost always been a part of my life. Like, I don't really remember a time before I was like worried about what I looked like. I was in beauty pageants as a kid, probably like 5, 6, 7 years old. But even before that, I have like very sticky outy ears. And so before I started preschool, there was like a big debate in my family of like, are we going to get her plastic surgery before she starts school? So it's like, I've always sort of been like worried about what I looked like, what that would mean for how others would perceive me and how I'd be like treated as a result. Like, it's just always been there. Yeah, I was in like Miss Saraville Petite and like Miss, you know, Young New Jersey when I was young as well. I really loved the talent portion. Like, that was why I did it. But I think the lesson that I internalized there was like, in order to do the thing you love, you first have to be beautiful. And I think I carried that with me throughout the rest of my life. As a kid, as a teen, I was very big into performing. I did musical theater. I was a singer-songwriter, so I was always on stage. And yeah, I mean, I think I probably put more effort into like looking like a singer-songwriter than actually doing the work. I wanted to be famous. And to me, that was like, you have to be beautiful first. Anyway, from there, I ended up moving to Los Angeles after college, working in the music industry as a wardrobe stylist. and somehow got into like celebrity lifestyle writing for magazines, eventually got recruited to work on the official Kardashian-Jenner apps in 2015, which was sort of my first entry point into the actual beauty industry, like writing about the beauty industry, being involved with PR and beauty products and beauty brands. And that kind of like blew my mind. After that, I started to pivot. I started to consider, what have I been focusing on for my whole life? Has this helped me or has it hurt me? And how does the beauty industry play into that and sort of capitalize on that in order to sell more products and create more insecurities? And yeah, ever since then, my focus has been critiquing the beauty industry.
What an interesting trajectory. I'm curious about that work for the Kardashian-Jenner apps. I know there's probably not a lot of specifics you can give, but just curious what that was like being in sort of the belly of the beast in some ways of the beauty industry and how you kind of really got from there to critiquing it.
Right. I mean, I loved my job. I will say that. I was an assistant editor before the apps even launched. So I was part of the team that launched all of the apps, and we created content every day that was about, you know, fashion and beauty, what they were wearing, what they were using, lifestyle things. So, I mean, it was a really interesting environment because I had so much fun creating the content. At the same time, it was like such a high pressure situation because it was like you're writing for the most famous women in the world. On top of that, it was the first time in my life I'd been on the receiving end of beauty products from brands through PR. They just give you free stuff. So I was using all of these products like very much into the work I was doing, very much into like the Kardashian ethos and aesthetic. And I think the combination of like the high stress work environment and then using all of these products at once, I started to have skin issues. I developed dermatitis. I was put on steroids for dermatitis. I had a really horrible reaction to the steroids over time. My face started like peeling off my body, essentially. It took months to heal. And so in researching how to heal without products, because I couldn't put anything on my face, I sort of had these two pathways of realization at the same time. One, I was like, wow, none of these products that I've trusted for my whole life are actually helping or healing in any way. Like a lot of products and prescriptions exacerbate skin problems. So why are we so invested in products? And at the same time, I was like, wow, when I can't wear makeup, when I don't feel beautiful, I actually feel absolutely worthless. And how did I get to this point in my life where I don't have anything else that I value in myself? Where when I'm not beautiful, I feel like nothing. Through those two points, the physical and like the psychological, spiritual, I just started to dive into like the history of beauty culture, really, both from like a product perspective and from just like an emotional health perspective. And I was like, this is all I want to do for the rest of my life is learn more about this, to learn more about how I got to where I am and how to get better. And so from there, I started writing for outlets like Allure and Vogue and New York Times and The Guardian, and eventually launched my own newsletter where I cover these topics more in depth.
What was that like writing for mainstream outlets about beauty when you had this sort of burgeoning anti-beauty culture stance?
I went into it very naive. I thought I was going to change the beauty industry. I thought the reason this information isn't out there is because no one knows it. And then I started writing for mainstream beauty outlets and I realized like, oh no, there's a reason why none of this is being talked about. And the reason is brands and advertising and industry and money and clicks. And it's just like not profitable to say, hey, you don't actually need this product. Or like, hey, this insecurity was actually developed and created by executives to sell you a thing that you don't need and will in fact make the issue you're trying to solve worse. There were a lot of ways that advertisers really influenced the content that was being created. I constantly had to sort of edit my stories, soften my stories. Brand names would be taken out. Things would have to be made like more vague to the point of just being, why am I even writing this? So it definitely was a struggle at times. But I also like to point out that like while I was working in the beauty industry, like writing for the beauty industry, I had started out with this like passion to change things. And like probably three or four times, I got sucked back into the cycle of, oh, products are great as long as I'm using clean products. I came up with all of these ways to still be a part of the beauty industry and justify what I was doing. And it was just like a lesson that I had to learn over and over and over again before I finally was like, no, I'm going to just stop. I'm just going to step away from all of the politics of the beauty industry and the products of the beauty industry and try to do my own thing.
Yeah. I want to talk more about that discourse around clean beauty and to me, that's where a lot of the intersection between beauty culture and wellness culture lives, is like this discourse around clean beauty and this attention to supposedly toxic ingredients and the veneer of sustainability and eco-friendliness being used to sell products that are actually harmful in many ways. We see that a lot with wellness food stuff too, right? This idea of like clean food being supposedly better and the actual harms of that marketing and that sort of positioning of things being quote unquote clean. Can you talk about some of the issues with this rhetoric and with this notion of clean beauty and the big piece that's really missing when we talk about supposedly clean or non-toxic beauty products?
Right. Oh my gosh, there's so much. I do want to start out by saying, like, there is a kernel of truth in all of this, right? Like, the beauty industry, like, truly does not have our best interests at heart. And there are products that are formulated that are not, you know, what I would consider like safe or useful to human health and flourishing. But any like good intention, once commodified, is corrupted. And that's sort of what's happened with the clean beauty industry. It's taken, you know, reasonable arguments and turned them into selling points to sell more products, which often like are pushing the same quote unquote toxic beauty standards. If we're talking about wellness, if we're talking about overall wellness, the thing that we should be focusing on are the standards of beauty that are embedded in these products, whether conventional or clean, because those are the things that are having more of a health effect on our bodies, really, on our minds and bodies, is like this idea that we have to change ourselves in order to fit this certain standard of what wellness looks like. And through that, we're actually seeing increased instances of like appearance-related anxiety, depression, dysmorphia, whether the product in question is conventional or clean. And then for like sustainability, I was really pulled into the sustainable beauty industry for a while. And then I had all these brands sending me their, you know, quote unquote, sustainable products. And I would see the boxes piling up at my front door. And eventually it just hit me like there's so much waste in trying to make a product that's sustainable when really the most sustainable thing would be to like educate people on where they can divest from products that aren't sustainable or aren't, you know, quote unquote, clean and safe and healthy, rather than creating these entirely new product categories. I mean, there's value in some of it, of course, but it's gotten to the point where I don't know that the clean industry is net positive compared to the alternative. Like, it's all pretty corrupt, if you ask me.
Right. It's all still pushing consumption and the development of new products for people to buy and pushing people to consume at the same level maybe that they did before, but it's just swapping one type of product for another rather than questioning the whole premise in the first place.
Right. Exactly.
Another thing that I see as sort of an intersection of wellness culture and beauty culture is that there's this notion of like glowing from within, right? And if you just, in wellness culture, it's like if you just eat the right foods and have the correct wellness routine and are generally well in the sort of right ways, then you'll have glowing skin and you'll match up with beauty standards. And if you don't meet beauty standards, then it must mean you're unwell and that there's something wrong with you under the surface, right? And I think I really bought into this many years ago when I was very caught up in wellness culture and trying to treat everything quote unquote naturally and like eschewing conventional medicine in some cases in favor of, you know, dietary changes and stuff like that, and thinking that I could fix it all myself. And I did struggle in the conventional healthcare system to get the kind of support that I needed. So it's understandable that I'd be attracted to taking matters into my own hands to some degree. But I think there was this sense that if I fix all of these problems with me, then I'll look the way that I think I should look. You know, I'll match conventional beauty standards. I'll be this level of thin that I'm striving for that I could never attain without extreme disorder in my eating, and it was never enough. And there was always something else I was chasing, and that I would glow and like my skin would be good. And I have eczema and contact dermatitis and acne and all these things. And I was always sort of chasing this notion of like skin perfection through eating the right things and being well in the right way or whatever. And I think it's really interesting that glowing from within now is often used to sell beauty and skincare products. They're supposed to put them on the outside to make us look like we're quote unquote well or glowing from within. And then there's also like the supplement thing that's crossing over there, where there's people like, I think it's Bobby Brown, who has like a supplement line about glowing from within. And so it's really interesting to see those messages and that sort of cross-pollination between wellness and beauty culture. Have you seen those messages showing up, and how do you see them causing harm?
Oh yeah. I mean, I see them all the time. If you look at like the majority of the wellness industry, it's actually the beauty industry. Like, so many of the claims of wellness products, whether it's a food or a supplement or a diet or even an exercise routine, it's how are you going to look? Will you appear well rather than will you be well? So I think that's such an important thing to point out. I think this idea that like who you are is what you look like is so strong right now. Like I will have a really hard time like forming an identity without consuming something, forming an identity without looking a certain way. And we've conflated like being a person to appearing. And that's just very dangerous, like psychologically on a spirit level, you know, but also creates all of these problems for like our actual bodies because we're, you know, putting things on them and in them in service to this like beauty ideal that's not actually like making us well. It's making us like obsessed with beauty and wellness to an unwell degree, right? So yeah, I mean, I see that all the time. I think that's a huge issue. And again, it's like sometimes there is truth to some of this. What I've seen happening is like, it's kind of all or nothing when things are industrialized for the beauty industry, for the wellness industry. Like, yes, it's true that some foods will have an impact on your skin for better or for worse. Like if you have an intolerance to something or an allergy, yeah, that'll show up on your skin. Like that's actually one of the body's like most beautiful methods of communication. You know, you eat something you're allergic to, you break out in hives. That's a survival mechanism, right? Your body has found a way to give you a visual cue that something is off. Another thing I like to point out is like the skin barrier, which is the body's like protective measure. It protects you from the sun. It protects you from environment. It protects you from, you know, invading pathogens and bacteria. That's made up of mostly omega fatty acids, essential omega fatty acids. You can only get those really from eating. The body doesn't produce them on its own. So like, of course, there are ways that these things can benefit your skin or harm your skin. I think what's happened, and that's really dangerous, is like taking these sort of like acute medical circumstances and universalizing them to everyone as an everyday practice. Like your body does not need medical intervention on a daily basis for most people for regular maintenance. And just like by recognizing these like one or two, you know, true scenarios and turning them into industries and expectations for all has just created this sort of like obsession with things to the point where it takes something that could be useful and blows it out of proportion to the point that it's no longer useful, like as a metric of wellness or well-being.
That's really interesting. I mean, it seems like from your experience of having your skin react so intensely to the products you were using, that was a clear signal your skin was giving you that these were not useful and helpful to you, like, to stop using products, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that's like a much healthier way to look at our skin and its reactions. Like everything that happens is a message. That message is morally neutral. It doesn't mean you have good skin or bad skin. It doesn't mean like you've done a good job at wellness or a bad job at wellness. It's just information. The sad thing is that the beauty industry and the wellness industry make it so hard to find useful information. The information that's out there is largely sold to tying products that are not effective solutions.
Because if the solution really is listen to your skin and stop using all these topical things that are irritating it, that's not beneficial to the beauty industry or to whoever's trying to sell you the stuff.
Yeah, it's such an individual thing. And I don't think like mainstream coverage of beauty and wellness really take that into account. Like what could be useful in terms of skin functioning for one person might not be necessary for another. You know, it's the same with like diets. Like not everyone needs to cut out gluten, but for people with like celiac disease, yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
This information has just been flattened to such a degree that it becomes problematic, even when it could be useful for one person.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that flattening, I think social media plays a huge role in that, right? I'm curious to hear sort of your thoughts on the role of social media in disseminating information about beauty that is flattened and sort of one size fits all and doesn't actually address people's real needs. And also how social media creates this environment where people do feel like they need to look a certain way in order to access their identities or sort of figure out who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit on like the two huge problems with social media. First, from an aesthetic standpoint, like social media and the functions of it, the filters, the Facetune, Photoshop, these things have completely changed the standard of beauty in a really short time. We are expecting like avatar level perfection from our real life faces. I mean, that has devastating effects on mental health and also physical health in some senses, from products to procedures to undergoing risky surgeries to sort of emulate these digital versions of ourselves in the physical world. And then, yeah, like you mentioned, the way that information spreads and it is popularized on social media is just, yeah, I don't think it's like focused on truth. It's focused on virality. And like very often, like the true thing is just very simple and boring. Honestly, like a lot of things can be addressed with like, are you drinking enough water? Are you sleeping? Like that, of course, has effects on your body, but like that's not fun to share on social, right? So it's like over the top ideas that spread really quickly and everyone wants to try them. And that's exciting because the truth of just basic body maintenance is boring. I'm not on social media anymore. I stopped using Instagram a couple of years ago. I never downloaded TikTok, which I'm very proud of. But when I was on social media, I would spend so much time, like I would be writing these articles for, say, the New York Times and put so much research into them, talk to experts, like write this really like thoughtful piece that I was proud of. And then you'd get like random people in your comments or sharing the article and tearing it down and being like, this isn't true. It's really hard, I think, for a journalist where you're like, but I've talked to so many experts. I've done so much research. And like all of that can be discredited by just like a random person who isn't actually like super familiar with the topic. So I think it's done like dangerous things for like health and wellness and beauty journalism as well.
Yeah, it really is demoralizing. I mean, I've had similar experiences covering wellness and nutrition and health. And from my perspective as a journalist and a dietitian, so I kind of have a like specific lens on things and anti-diet, and I treat disordered eating and all of that. So I'm kind of like bringing that, and but it's very evidence-based. And what I put out there is so, I research things so much and fact check so much. And for my books, I've had independent fact checkers that I've hired out of my own pocket and all of this stuff. And yeah, to have random people on social media or reviews just being like, this is bullshit, and tearing it down without really understanding it or even reading it in some cases, right? It's like just the idea of the book or the idea of the story is something that they don't like. And so they're willing to go on there. It's incredibly demoralizing. And I think has definitely made me, I mean, there's like a couple, I think a couple ways that that sort of algorithmic fanning of the flames of controversy can go, right? In some cases, it made me be more strident and more sort of like, I don't care, and more black and white in how I promoted things, because that got at least a lot of love and traction, even if it got haters too. It was like, it went more viral if I was more sort of black and white on social media versus things that were more nuanced and maybe more accurate. There's only so much you can fit in a meme or whatever, but like the things that had more nuanced words and more kind of squishiness didn't do as well. And then probably still were going to get torn down by commenters. And so I was just like, well, I'm going to do what seems to be working and sort of go in this more black and white direction. And that wasn't really an intentional choice. It was just kind of like, okay, here's what works. I'm going to do more of this, and found myself slowly getting pulled into this more strident black and white, less nuanced direction that ultimately isn't in line with my values or what I want to put out there in the world. And I think is harming the discourse, the fact that so many of us are getting pushed into these extremes and not talking in a more nuanced way about things.
I relate to that so much. I do feel like I got sucked into that a lot when I was in this phase of writing for the beauty media and focusing on clean beauty. I was such a supporter because I really believed in like these underlying truths that clean beauty is trying to address. And I did get sucked into this very black and white way of thinking, like you said. And there's so many articles that I wrote when I was working at that time that I would never write now. And I wish I would have injected more nuance into them, because like these things, you know, live on the internet still. And I'm like, I would have said that differently today. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's like anything, there are benefits to it. I do think like being pushed by online critics has made me a better researcher, or more like more cautious of saying something sensational if I don't have everything that could possibly back it up. That's good. That has improved my work. And then there's like a layer of it where you're just like scared to put something out, even though it could like help people or be really useful to somebody, because it's like, well, who's going to tear this down? Yeah, it's really tricky territory.
It is. Yeah, I think so harmful to our overall well-being and actual mental health to have that kind of discourse be going on. And then there's the misinformation piece too, right? Where it's like social media is spreading, you know, I see so much wellness and diet misinformation. I'm sure there's a lot of beauty misinformation out there too. What's your take on that? How do you think people can protect themselves from that part of social media?
Oh, that's such a good question. I mean, I would say if you can, like, get off. It really worked for me.
Uh-huh. Same.
I read fewer Instagram captions and more books, which I think has given me a more reasonable take on all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, I would just be skeptical of anyone who is directly involved in the industry. Like, bias happens. It's not like a character flaw. Like, it happens to everybody. That's why we like check for journalistic bias, or like journalists are not allowed to accept gifts, because these things happen. And so you take measures to mitigate that. So I would just be like a little skeptical of anyone who's like a brand founder or an influencer or a celebrity with a deal with a certain brand. Even I've seen a lot of like cosmetic chemists who work in the industry where it's like, of course, like industry creating these products is their bread and butter. They're not necessarily trying to bamboozle you, but being within that industry creates a certain bias.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would just like watch out for that. Just double, triple check any information that's coming to you from somebody who has a financial benefit to you believing it, product-wise, I think.
What about the filter piece, the beauty filters and Instagram face? You know, you've written about how that's influencing like the medical system and the surgical procedures people are coming in to get. How can, again, I think probably your answer is going to be get off social media. And I agree with that. But for people who feel like they have to be on there, but they're still sort of being fed this content that is highly filtered, like what can we do to be more skeptical or critical of it, or just kind of insulate ourselves a little bit from that influence?
You know, the filter piece is much harder to hide from. It's not as simple as get off social media, because it's really infiltrated almost all aspects of our lives. Like even just getting on a Zoom meeting for work, you're seeing people through a screen. Some people are using that blur effect. Like so much of our lives are virtual and digital, even if you're not scrolling social media all the time. And through that, you're seeing other people like through this lens, through this sort of like polished blurring lens that like obscures reality. But yeah, I think it's important to like have as much interaction with real people as possible. But even that, it's like a lot of real people are surgically enhancing themselves or procedurally enhancing themselves right now. So even having face-to-face interaction creates that comparison thing. I think just being mindful of it, just, you know, reminding yourself that people don't inherently look like this. This is a very specific choice, a very specific standard of beauty that's being handed to us right now. It just helps,
mm-hmm.
you know, to like keep that in check. And then for people who are like interested in wellness, which I think a lot of people are interested in these things because it projects this image of being well, be very careful about how you conceive of wellness versus looking well, and decide what is more important to you. Because we have plenty of data that shows this obsession with looking well, according to the standard of beauty today in the Western world, has actually devastating effects on our mental health. In chasing the aesthetic of wellness, you are making yourself less well. And I think just keeping that top of mind and making that conscious choice, like, no, if wellness is important to me, it's because I actually want to feel well, not look well. You know, influences our behaviors, emphasizes like our values. And I think living by your values eventually helps you build up that confidence to resist things that don't align with your values.
Mm. Well, I mean, speaking of the sort of effort to look well, undermining true well-being, I think that's, you see that very much in the pressure to lose weight and be thin and sort of the intertwining of wellness and diet culture. And I know you've talked about the intersections of beauty culture and diet culture. Can you talk a little bit about what those intersections are and also how you see beauty culture as being intertwined with other oppressive systems?
Mm-hmm. I describe beauty culture as diet culture's face-focused fraternal twin.
Mm.
Different body parts we're focused on usually, but the same underlying structures that are creating these standards, which are patriarchy. You know, this is a very gendered space. These standards mostly apply to women and gender nonconforming people. Capitalism, you know, there's always a product to buy. There's always more, more, more to do to improve yourself, to optimize yourself. colonialism and white supremacy. These are like the four main forces that create beauty culture and diet culture. And what I've seen really in the past, 5 to 10 years, especially, like that as we had that little bit of pushback to diet culture in the mainstream media, and we got all these like magazine covers that suddenly were like, love your body at any size, health at any size. We saw that entering the mainstream media. You can look at the data and see that the beauty industry and beauty culture starts to get stronger and stronger and stronger because it's compensating to meet whatever was lost in terms of like control and product sales as diet culture became less acceptable to promote in the mainstream media. We see beauty culture rising up to meet that. We see injectables becoming way more popular. We see skincare becoming this, you know, huge craze. There was like more of a focus above the neck. And so it was like we hadn't changed any of the underlying structures that created diet culture. We just sort of shifted our focus above the neck. And beauty culture is like thriving because of it. I think beauty culture has given people the language that allowed for what we're seeing now with this huge resurgence of diet culture, with, you know, thin being in again, not that it was ever really out, but the rise of Ozempic and all of this. Beauty culture, when it rose up to meet the space left by diet culture, introduced these ideas of like looking good as mental health. It created this idea of like, well, whatever I do to my body is autonomy and empowerment. Now we're seeing those arguments being applied to like losing weight. It's all the same stuff, just applied to different body parts. Skincare culture in particular, I call skincare culture dewy diet culture. And there are so many parallels there. I mean, ideologically, is there a difference between like fat rolls and frown lines? Like, if you're uncomfortable with someone saying, ugh, like too many fat rolls, you have to lose weight. Like, why are we comfortable with someone saying, oh, I got to get rid of my frown lines and this is empowerment? It's not. These are both just like basic realities of being a human in a body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think like there's such a lack of critical thinking there of what we're willing to say is like, you know, a quote unquote bad feature on somebody's face versus what we're comfortable with saying is a good or a bad feature on somebody's body.
Totally. So I'm sure that there are some people listening who will be like, yeah, but I just want to lose weight, or I just want to fix my wrinkles, or I just want to have skin stop sagging or whatever. And that would help me feel better about myself and feel better in the world. To me, that argument, I definitely understand that. I empathize with that. And I eschew most kind of cosmetic procedures, and I don't wear a lot of makeup, but I do sometimes still wear makeup to events and stuff like that if I'm going to be speaking or going to a wedding or whatever. And for me, I've sort of come to terms with that as like, this is my ticket to being taken seriously in professional spaces sometimes. This is my ticket to not having people be like, are you okay? Are you tired? Like, what's going on with you? Where sometimes I might answer that and have a conversation about that or whatever if people are judging me overtly, but that doesn't really happen. You know, I think it's more like in people's heads or whatever they might be thinking that. But I just, you know, sometimes I will sort of be okay with whatever I'm imagining people are thinking about me. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I just don't want to deal with it. I want to fit in this situation so that I can think and talk about other things and not have my appearance be sort of central or not like stick out in this situation because I need to blend in order to get things done, get my message across, do the work that I need to do or whatever, you know? So I kind of see it as like a ticket in or a ticket to getting what I need to do done in some ways, but I'm also not doing like surgical procedures or anything like that. Not that I haven't been tempted. You know, I had serious acne when I did IVF to have my daughter, and I had like the worst acne of my life and had pitting scars and stuff as a result, and have thought about, do I want to get that removed? Or these, like, I go back and forth feeling like, oh, this doesn't feel like me or whatever. Or, you know, these are my battle scars. This tells the story of what I went through to have my daughter. And this is beautiful. And this is a part of me, and I'm going to embrace it. We're not going to look like we did in our 20s forever. And I'm in my 40s now, and I have changed and have grown. And these scars are part of that. And that's mostly where I land. But there are moments when I'm like, but I just want them gone. So I'm very compassionate with that sort of thinking. But I'm curious sort of how you personally have kind of started to relate to these things and how you would advise or encourage other people maybe to see their relationship with beauty culture and to start to change it?
Right. Oh, there's so much there. First of all, I would say, like, for anyone who's like, well, I like this, or I want to look like this. Of course you like this. Of course you want to look differently. This is what our culture glorifies and upholds as an ideal. Looking a certain way is a ticket to sometimes higher paying jobs, better jobs. I mean, social opportunities, relationship, love opportunities, like all of those things are very real, and it can make changing your body to meet the beauty ideal seem like a rational choice. So of course I understand that. What frustrates me is when we stop there and say, okay, I'm going to change my body, instead of working to change the values of society. That's been a big refrain for me personally, is like, I don't want to change my body to meet the standard of beauty. I want to change what is expected of women so that I don't have to put my body and my mind in danger to meet this ideal. There's also a great quote that I repeat to myself all of the time from sociologist Tressie McMillan Cotton. And she said, I like what I like is always a capitalist lie. Has really been an invitation to me to interrogate my own likes and wants and things that I'm like drawn to, and really sort of dismantle that and ask myself, why do I like this? Is it coming from within me, or is it something conditioned into me by a society that doesn't actually have my best interests in mind? And that's just like, that's part of getting to know yourself, which I find thrilling. So it's not like a self-critique necessarily, but an invitation to like know yourself deeper and find out what your likes really are versus something that you have been conditioned to like. So that's sort of where I land with that. My work is like just trying to tell the truth about some of these things, because I think the truth is so obscured in like the mainstream beauty media and social media. I'll just speak for me. Like when I learn about like the history of some of these beauty standards and the oppressive systems that have given rise to these beauty standards, like I always say, beauty standards are the physical manifestations of systems of oppression. The reason the standard of beauty is often Eurocentric, fatphobic, ableist, gendered, all of this is because those systems of oppression have shaped our society. And these are the physical outgrowths. So it's been really useful for me to like learn that history, focus on that history, and then ask myself, is this something that I'm like willing to be a part of? And then also, do I, because the standard of beauty is sort of forced upon us and it creates this feeling of insecurity, this lack of confidence. The other part there is like asking myself, do I have like the emotional, mental energy to divest from that standard right now? It doesn't have to be like you have to drop it all at once. But I do think it is a good practice to start recognizing, I tend to call some of my beauty behaviors cosmetic coping mechanisms. I wear concealer sometimes. I have a lot of acne scarring. I don't wear concealer because I like it. It doesn't necessarily make me feel better. It like mitigates what had made me feel bad, which is exactly the same thing. And so just telling myself the truth that like, I don't like this. This isn't great for me. But I'm doing it to cope with a society that's going to judge me if I show up at an event full of acne scars with no makeup on. And I just contextualize that as like, okay, it's a cosmetic coping mechanism. Like coping mechanisms can be great. Eventually, sometimes you want to like work through the actual problem so you don't have to cope with it. And so I feel like me personally, I'm always working toward that and then trying to let go of as many of these beauty behaviors and coping mechanisms as I can along the way, because through my research, I know they are not actually serving me. Another framework that I like to keep in mind is like, beauty culture sort of creates this like binary of the economic well-being versus existential well-being, right? So the things that are like conforming to the standard of beauty that will give us like access to this economic system, give us more success in certain situations, creates like an existential issue on the other end, right? So that's something that I like to think about as well. Like, will the like economic boost that this thing gives me be worth it on the existential end?
Wow.
Yeah. Most of the time it's a no. Of course, that's like, I want to recognize like that's coming from a place of privilege in a lot of ways for me. I'm a middle-class white woman. So often like I can forego some of these like economic benefits of conforming to beauty in a way that not everybody can. And that's important to like to note as well, but I just in the back of my mind, it's like, it's always going to be better for us existentially to remove ourselves from these systems as much as we can.
What about ageism? How do you see that playing in? Because I think that's a big one where our society devalues people as they age and sees signs of aging as signs of that people are losing value. I mean, especially for women and gender nonconforming people. So how can people who are older, who are having signs of aging, kind of grapple with this and use whatever cosmetic coping mechanisms they need to use while at the same time, you know, really starting to question these systems?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great question. I often like forget to even mention ageism when I'm talking about beauty because it's so ingrained. It's just like that sort of is the standard of beauty is youth, right? But yes, no, ageism is a huge part of what's happening with beauty standards today. As far as, you know, the cosmetic coping part of it and grappling with, am I going to get work done or am I going to resist? One thing I like to point out is that you're going to be criticized for it anyway. Like there truly is no way to win. It's either, oh, she got work done or bad work done, or she doesn't look good, or she has wrinkles, she looks old, she doesn't look good for her age, whatever. There's criticism on either end. And so when it comes to a situation like that, personally, I tend to think I'm going to choose the path that like more aligns with my values if I'm going to be criticized anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's really difficult. There was an article in the Financial Times a couple years ago that I think about constantly on this subject, and it framed ageism as a form of discrimination against yourself. Like if you're lucky, you'll grow old. And so that's really helped me in like worrying about looking older and taking measures to look younger. Like I don't do anti-aging things. I don't do cosmetic procedures. I would go so far as to say I never will when it comes to aging, because not only is it like devastating on the collective level, but that's a form of discrimination against myself. I'm just making it harder for myself to grow old by my own standards. So of course there's like a cultural weight put on that, but I don't know, for me, it's useful to recognize the individual weight that I'm putting on it and that I'm actually like actively making it harder for myself to accept myself as I grow old if I'm obsessed with reversing it.
I think about that a lot too. In my 40s, definitely showing some signs of aging that maybe not other people might not totally notice, but I'm looking at my face every day, definitely notice these things. But yeah, I think for me at this point in my life, I don't think it's worth it. The calculus comes out in favor of acceptance and aging without those sorts of cosmetic coping mechanisms. And who knows, when I get into my 50s, 60s, whatever, that might feel like it starts to shift. But I feel like living in line with my values feels so much more aligned with just who I am at this point in my life and who I want to be. And also the model I want to give for other people too, because I think that would be discriminating against myself. And that would also be, you know, showing my daughter and other people in my life that it's not acceptable to age, that my face without cosmetic enhancements or whatever is not a good face. And that there's a sort of implied judgment sometimes, I think. I don't know. When I encounter people who've had a lot of work done in my life, I sometimes think, oh God, they must be judging me, you know? And who knows if that's true. That's probably a projection in a lot of cases. But I don't want anyone in my family, at least, I don't want my daughter to be feeling that way or even having that cross her mind, you know, as a result of my enhancements or whatever.
I think it's so important to highlight like our role in the collective. I think one of like the worst things about beauty culture and wellness culture is like it perpetuates a sort of individualism, my wants and my needs above everybody else's. And it sort of downplays like how we are all interconnected and how our actions actually do have collective consequences. Mm-hmm. And yeah, by participating in anti-aging culture, you're doing it, you know, quote unquote, for yourself. But I mean, it's just a fact that our actions have consequences on the collective. Our action, our adherence upholds the standard of beauty. Like, not putting a moral judgment on that, not saying it's good or bad for you to invest or divest, but like, that's just simply the truth of how beauty standards work. We cannot separate our own individual actions from their collective consequences. And yeah, I think that's especially powerful when you're looking at, say, your daughter growing up and like, what do I want her to feel as she grows older? Do I want her to be scared of this? Do I want to give her the impression that this is something to be avoided at all costs? Yeah, and that can be really powerful. And the other thing I like to mention is like, anti-aging is terrible for us on a longevity level as well. There was a study, I think, out of Yale a while ago that showed people with negative attitudes toward aging ended up dying 7.5 years earlier than subjects in the study who did not have a negative attitude toward aging. So like this anti-aging obsession is literally anti-aging us. It's literally taking years off of our lives. And I think that's such a huge example of like this big void between the idea of like looking well and being well. Are you willing to give up 7.5 years of your actual life to look as if you've lived less life?
God, that's so intense and so important to recognize. And also, I mean, like the risks of cosmetic surgery or cosmetic, you know, injections or whatever it might be are not zero, right? You're also sort of rolling the dice when you're doing something like that.
100%. And that's definitely something that's not talked about enough in the mainstream beauty media, is that all of these things have potential consequences on our actual health in the name of looking healthy.
Yeah. One question that I ask all my guests at the end is how you're rethinking wellness for yourself. And in light of the work you do critiquing the beauty industry and beauty culture, I'm curious what wellness means to you and sort of how you're rethinking really more well-being. I like to say well-being as opposed to wellness, because wellness has been so, word wellness and the concept of wellness has just been so thoroughly co-opted by wellness culture and the wellness industry. And, you know, I think true well-being is something that's far outside of what wellness culture really conceptualizes it as. But I'm curious if that any of that resonates for you and sort of how you're rethinking wellness or well-being for yourself in light of the work you do.
Yes. It's interesting. I don't know if this is a great answer, but something that I was even just thinking about this morning is like obsession. Like if something comes to a point of obsession, it's probably not well. And like the obsession with wellness in culture today points to like very unwell society that's constantly chasing wellness because we don't feel well. And so something I've been thinking about for myself is like, the less like I'm obsessed with wellness, the less I'm like trying to chase wellness, it's probably a sign that like I'm doing pretty okay.
Yeah.
I'm probably pretty well if I don't feel this like intense obsession with performing wellness. And I was thinking of that this morning because, like I said, I didn't know if we were going on camera, talking to each other on this podcast. And I've had such a rough morning. Like I didn't wash my face or brush my hair today. I had to like run out to the pharmacy for a prescription. And I was just like, I don't feel up to this. And I'm going on a wellness podcast. Like, what are people going to think? And then I was like, you know what? I did things today that were actually for my own wellness. Like I picked up a prescription. I'm taking action. I didn't waste precious moments of my morning, like needing to brush my hair or like wash my face and do these things, because I was actually taking care of myself in like ways that are more well than the performance of well. So that's how I'm thinking about it today.
Oh, I love that. And I always say like medication is a form of self-care. There's so much in wellness culture that is anti-meds and pro fix it with food or whatever. But I have personally tried that myself in the past and it didn't work. And I've done a lot of research around it. And, you know, a lot of the ways that we're conditioned to try to fix things through food or supplements or other wellness protocols are just not evidence-based and are not supportive of actual well-being, but prescription medications and over-the-counter medications really are in many cases. And so, yeah, I think that's really amazing. And
I mean, if there's a food that will take away the pain of a UTI, tell me about
it. Oh my God, the worst. I hate that so much. But yeah, no, I used to like try to treat UTIs with food and got myself into some really bad situations, because if you don't treat a UTI properly and the bacteria keep multiplying, they can go other places and cause other problems. And yeah, it's not a good scene.
No, not at all. I'm feeling pretty well today, even though I don't necessarily look it.
I love that. And yeah, it's like, who cares? And also we're off camera anyway. So there's that. You don't have to have your ticket in the door of like, whatever. I so appreciate that. Well, thank you for everything you shared. It's really a pleasure talking with you. And I'm excited to talk more for the bonus episode. But for those who are just listening to this episode, can you tell people where they can find you and learn more about your work?
Yes. So most of my work is on my newsletter. It's called The Unpublishable. Actually, that name will be changing soon. I'm going to do a rebrand. coming months, but you can find it at jessicadefino.substack.com. I'm also a columnist at The Guardian. So every month I have a column called Ask Ugly, a beauty advice column. So you can find me there as well.
Awesome. We'll put links to that in the show notes so people can find it. I love your writing and definitely encourage people to check it out. And thank you again. This was really lovely.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's our show. Thanks to our guest for being here and to you for listening. If you've enjoyed this conversation, I'd be so grateful if you could take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can also support us by becoming a paid subscriber for just a few bucks a month on Substack. With a paid subscription, you unlock great perks like bonus episodes, subscriber-only Q&As, early access to regular episodes, and much more. Sign up now at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. That's rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Got burning questions about wellness trends, diet fads, or anything else we cover on the show? Send them my way at christyharrison.com/questions for a chance to have them answered on an upcoming episode. And if you're looking to heal your relationship with food and break free from diet and wellness culture, I'd love for you to check out my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. You can learn more and enroll now at christyharrison.com/course. Rethinking Wellness is produced and edited by Softer Sounds Podcast Studio. Julianne Witasik does our website production. Our album art was created by Tara Jacoby. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs. And I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and take care.